No debate about the greatest World Series of all time goes without mentioning the one between the Cincinnati Reds and Boston Red Sox in 1975, a series that earned its place in baseball history with its competitiveness and popularity among the American public. Even 40 years later, it remains iconic, and we'll recall this seven-game epic with four of its major figures. But before we delve into the World Series itself, some background on how each team reached the Fall Classic. The Reds were that day's definition of a super team, the Big Red Machine as they were called. Manager Sparky Anderson directed a group that included Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan, and Tony Perez. Cincinnati cruised to the National League West crown by 20 games, winning 108 times during the regular season. But for all that talent in place, the Reds had yet to go the distance in the postseason. They won the pennant in 1970, but lost to Baltimore in the World Series. They were NL champs again in 1972, but fell to Oakland in seven games. 1 year later, Cincy was done in by the underdog New York Mets in the National League Championship Series. Perez and the rest of the Reds understood there was pressure to break through and win it all.
Yeah, we knew we lost to our first two World Series, like you mentioned, and then 70 and 72, and then we come back in 75, and we know we have to win. We know we got a name, a Big Red Machine, and most people know that Sparky Anderson, the manager, he was worrying about that, especially when we got down on the seven game, you know, in the sixth game when we lost the sixth game and they tied the series. He was worrying on the seven because we got down 3-0 in the sixth inning, and we might lose the game, and that's why he was worrying, but. And we know we got another game to play after the sixth game, and we had to play hard and come back, and we did come back and win that game.
While the Reds were experienced, the Red Sox were mostly newcomers, veteran Carl Yastrzemski being one of the lone exceptions. The best examples of this infusion of young talent were the team's two first-year outfielders. Center fielder Fred Lynn hit 21 home runs, had a team-best 105 runs batted in, hit .331, and became the first to win Rookie of the Year and Most Valuable Player in the same season. Left fielder Jim Rice slugged 22 home runs and drove in 102. The two were integral in Boston winning 95 games and besting Baltimore by 4.5 games in the American League East standings. But by the end of the regular season, Rice had suffered a wrist injury and would be out for the playoffs. For Lynn and his younger teammates, it didn't deter them as they went on to the ALCS against the three-time defending champion Oakland A's, a series they would go on to sweep. However, Rice's loss played a major role in the outcome of the World Series.
I believe that we were so young. I knew how good Oakland was, but, you know, all the young guys, you know, we're full of bravado, and, you know, we think that we can beat anybody. You know, maybe the veteran players probably were saying, okay, we got to knock these guys off. They're three-time world champs, and we've got to beat them, especially at their place, and they've got a great pitching staff. But I remember during the season, we played them pretty tough. They were the other division, so we didn't see them very often, but we played them tough, and we matched up pretty well against their pitching staff. All our lefty hitters could hit their lefty pitching, and so that kind of neutralized that. And, you know, our pitching wasn't bad either. You know, we had some guys that could twirl the ball. But we went in there, and, gosh, every guy hit .350, seems like. And we just kind of steamrolled them. I mean, the games were close, but it was like you're playing tennis and you win all the close points. That's what happened. Anytime we needed a hit, we got it. We needed to make a play, we made it. So we dispatched them pretty easily, and I believe that raised some eyebrows. And when Cincinnati came steamrolling into the series, I'm sure that they took note. You know, they probably thought that they would play Oakland. And then they said, well, who are these Red Sox guys? And, you know, they knew Yaz and Petroselli and some of the older players, established guys. They really didn't know us because we never saw them. So I'm sure they thought that they would dispatch us like they did everybody else. But, you know, we gave them a heck of a series. And had we had Jimmy Rice for the series, I truly believe that we would have beaten them in six. haven't even gone Game 7. Because Jimmy's replacement, Juan Benitez, I don't even know if he got a hit during the series. And Jimmy was a main part of our offense. You know, he hit four or five in the lineup, and you take that guy out of our lineup, and, you know, we're not as good. So, and we played them tough, even without Jimmy. But like I said, if we had him, I truly believe that we'd have beaten them.
As the Red Sox waited to meet the Reds, who had just swept Pittsburgh in their league championship series, one Boston player was quite familiar with the other side. Bernie Carbo, a member of Cincinnati's 1970 pennant-winning club, lent insight into its talented roster.
I was the only ball player that played for the Cincinnati Reds, and also being able to be in a World Series in 1970 with Cincinnati and the Big Red Machine. So when we were playing them in the World Series, during the meetings, you know what? They have such a scouting report, and scouts that go out, and they check all the ball clubs and all the teams and things like that. Basically, I said, you know, Johnny Bench was a fastball catcher. Behind on the counts, he should be looking for a fastball. I also thought that I said that David Concepcion, if you throw him inside, he's, you know, you can go outside with him. I said, Tony Perez, you can't throw him the same pitch twice. I said, they got a tremendous team. I said, you know, they got good pitching. I think it's going to be a good World Series.
Well, the star of the opening game of the 75 World Series was Red Sox starter Louis Tiant. He thrilled the Fenway faithful by pitching a complete game 5-hit shutout and also keying a 6-run Boston 7th with a single in his first plate appearance of the year. The gem was finished off in the top of the 9th against Dave Concepcion.
One ball, two strikes. Crowd on its feet here at Fenway on an overcast, raw day. And Petrocelli gloves it. In time. And the Red Sox have drawn first blood in the 1975 World Series. Louis Tiant, with the help of a 6-run 7th, spins a 5-hit shutout to give the Sox the victory.
Dick, they played a flawless game. They just can't make a mistake in the field. That last play by Petrocelli was a sparkler. Yastrzemski, Freddie Lynn, they're taking the extra base. They're doing everything that the book says you're supposed to do to play baseball.
And these Red Sox players, Kurt, like to be the underdogs. They like to know that somebody feels that the other club will win. They handle the Baltimore pressure, as you mentioned, beat Oakland in three straight games, the three-time defending champs, and there you see Louis Tiant getting congratulations and a whale of a game for him.
For Game 2, it was Cincinnati's Jack Billingham against Boston's Bill Lee. The spaceman had won 17 games for the Sox and, going into the contest, was confident in knowing that the Reds' hitters were unfamiliar with his pitching style.
You know, a left-hander that can turn the ball over against a superior right-handed lineup has the advantage. You know, and I thought I did a good job. At the end of the series, they said, Sparky Anderson said I was the best starting pitcher of all of them, and I was very proud of that. I had the lead in the ninth inning, and then we had a rain delay. And the rain delay really, I should not have gone back out and thrown the ninth and had Bench hit that leadoff double against me. In modern baseball, if we had had Roger Maret, if he had come in and thrown for me in the ninth inning, I think we would have won that World Series. But it was not to be.
They're going to go to the bullpen. They want the right-hander, Dick Drago, to come on to pitch to Perez. So Bill Lee, who will get quite a hand here as he leaves. Here it is. Everybody up at Fenway, the Red Sox faithful. Lee worked 8 innings plus, giving up 5 hits and 1 run. Walked 2, struck out 4.
Following Lee's departure, the Reds scored 2 in the top of the 9th to take a 3-2 lead. Raleigh Eastwick held that lead and even the series at a game apiece heading to the Queen City. The scene shifted to Riverfront Stadium, and Game 3 was not without its share of late drama and controversy. In the bottom of the 10th, with the score knotted at 5 and Cesar Geronimo on first, Reds pinch hitter Ed Armbrister and Red Sox catcher Carlton Fisk collided after a bunt in front of home plate. Interference was not called. Fisk's impeded throw to second base was high and drifted into center field, allowing Geronimo to advance to third with none out. Naturally, it incited a spirited discussion between Boston manager Darryl Johnson and home plate umpire Larry Barnett.
10th inning in the final game at Pittsburgh in the National League playoffs. Provide the winning run. Throw to second. High. And Fisk over to third. Safe.
We are going to have
that at second.
We're going to have an argument. They may reverse this decision.
The Red Sox are arguing interference at the plate.
They are saying that a batter, after bunting, interfered with Carlton Fisk, the catcher, in fair territory. He has to give room to Carlton Fisk so he can make the play. There's Darryl Johnson.
He was interfering, and you went to call it.
Well, sir,
you tell me what you were calling, then, when he did it.
On a play like that,
I'm telling you, the man interfered with that man on the play. I'm telling you, I want to see a man down here. Come here.
Apparently, home plate umpire Larry Barnett is not going to reverse his decision. He might ask for help for somebody else. One of the other umpires who they feel might have had a better look. Well, let's wait and see what happens. That's what Darryl Johnson wants. He's calling first base umpire Dick Stallo right now.
Tell me that you can't help him on a play like that when he hasn't even touched the ball. And the man was interfering with him.
Listen to me. There's no interference when a ball is hit and the catcher goes for the ball and the batter tries to get out of the box.
And the batter tries to get out of the way. He was all over the catcher.
Now, when the batter comes out of the box after hitting the ball and the catcher makes a play, there is no interference.
I'm going to tell you something. That's not the way the play went. I'll tell you that.
Is that a gamble play at second by Fisk?
Absolutely, Kurt. And, well, I'll tell you, to be honest about it, Tony, I don't know how you feel, but he may well have a valid argument, both Carlton Fisk and Darryl Johnson.
Darryl Johnson right now is saying, I want to hear from Dick Stallo, but apparently Larry Barnett is saying, no, I made the call, I'm sticking with it. Darryl Johnson saying, he interfered with my man, my catcher, Carlton Fisk, in fair territory.
I'll tell you one thing. I don't know what you're going to make a ruling on that, but I want you to explain exactly what you were looking at when you called the play.
Okay, the guy, the ball was hit, he was moving for the ball, and the runner was moving to first.
The runner was all over the catcher in there.
I can't help that. It happened right there.
I'll tell you one thing. It's a lousy operation, and you and I know it right now. It's a lousy operation.
Well, I had a great vantage point because the play's right in front of me. Anytime there's a bunt like that, my first move is coming in because I'm backing up second base for an overthrow. And I could see there was a collision right in front of the plate. I couldn't see who instigated it, but, you know, the rule is if you interfere with the fielder's line to the ball or his chance to make a play, you know, that's interference, whether it's intentional or not. So it was definitely a botched call. Larry Barnett was the home plate umpire. And I remember years after, every time he would umpire in Fenway, the fans never forgot. Because they always announced the umpires. And now, behind the plate, Larry Barnett, boo! So they never forgot. And you know, that was a key play. You know, Pudge was really upset. You know, Pudge is a big guy. You know, and if he stumbles, you know, because the guy is in his way, well, then he's really in his way. He's 6'3", 225. So, you know, it takes a little bit more than just a brush by to knock him off balance. So, you know, it was just a rub of the green, and it didn't go our way. But we still battled. We lost that game, but I don't know if that was the deciding factor.
Joe Morgan's single won it later that inning, giving Cincinnati a 2-1 advantage. The Red Sox answered the next night behind another Teon complete game, despite allowing 4 runs and 9 hits.
Well, you know, really was such a tremendous feat. He's a Hall of Fame feat to me. And he was throwing the ball very, very well. He knew how to pitch, and he knew how to get you out. He did in almost 2 games in that series. He did in 2 games, and then he got a chance to pitch in the third game because they rained out. You know, we had 3-day rain, and we got 3 games, and he got come back and pitch the third game. I think he almost lost that game. But, I mean, Louis Moore had a face-off pitching in Louis, and he was good.
Boston's offense struck primarily in the fourth with a five spot, highlighted by a Dwight Evans triple, a Rick Burleson double, and a Carl Yastrzemski single, all resulting in runs batted in. The main offensive hero for pivotal Game 5 was Tony Perez. He slugged a pair of home runs as the Reds won 6-2.
If your pitcher does his job.
Well, there's a blast into deep left center field, and it's tied up.
Boy, he's happy. He clapped his hands as he rounded first base. He finally broke out of it.
Reds dug out a little bit happy, you might say, and Joe Morgan there all smiles. Sparky Anderson, they love to see this guy hit.
He hits a blast in the deep left center. That's gone. Way back.
With Cincinnati up 3-2 and just one win from the title, the stage was set for the classic Game 6. Our discussion of that epic, as well as the dramatic Game 7, to be featured in our next episode, as we look back at the 1975 World Series.